You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. With me is my co-host, psychologist, Dr. Melody Fox. Melody, it is great to have your beautiful voice and point of view back with us.
Well, thanks a lot, Alan. I appreciate that. I'm very happy to be back here because each week we bring, along with you, guests that can help inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future.
And we will bring you we will address issues such as locating your runaway teens, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and many great ways to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually healthy.
With each of us having over 30 years experience working with families in crisis, we have both been very fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are helping to make this world a better place for all of us.
And we will continue to bring you these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Today, we have two such caring and dedicated individuals with us to talk about community-based treatment for troubled youth in the juvenile justice system.
With some of the factors that contribute to delinquency of troubled youth, such as mental health and substance abuse issues in the juvenile justice system, we're going to be talking about a national movement towards community-based treatment approaches as an alternative to detention.
And our guests today are Richard Lewis III and Tommy Baines. Richard is a senior associate with Open Minds, a national market research and management consulting firm specializing in mental health, addictions, social services, and other related public sectors of the health and human services field. A former assistant director of the San Bernardino County Department of Behavioral Health, Richard also has over 20 years' experience as an administrator in private sector behavioral health. Richard is currently a volunteer police officer with the City of Monterey Park in Los Angeles, where he holds the rank of captain, assigned to the department's gang enforcement unit.
And Tommy Baines is a deputy probation officer in Los Angeles County who has worked with youth and families for over 25 years. And in addition to his field work with juveniles, he has served the department as a therapist and as an analyst with responsibility for program development, grant writing, and strategic planning. Now, currently, Tommy is a member of the youth resource team in the City of Santa Monica, and he consults regularly with administrators from a variety of agencies on issues with youth and justice systems. So, gentlemen, welcome to Answers for the Family. We're very happy to have you here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much. Happy
Good
to be
morning.
Here.
All right.
So, I'm just curious, what are local law enforcement agencies, both probation and police departments, doing to deal with delinquency youth as a result of, let's just jump into it, all the shrinking budgets over the last few years? Because that's got to have changed the landscape.
It has changed it some. Some things haven't changed, though. I think police departments and probation departments have always had to decide what you're going to do with your offender population.
Mm-hmm.
There's been what I think has happened with the shrinking budgets is we've reached a consensus now.
Mm-hmm.
We've gone from a time where some people thought you ought to be more punitive and other people thought, well, we should work with them more.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's agreement between both factions that we can't afford to incarcerate everyone or mm-hmm. detain everyone who's committed a crime.
Mm-hmm.
So once you have that, now the question is, what do we do with those, who are we going to detain with our limited resources?
Mm-hmm.
And I think in California, we've sort of answered that question with the more serious violent offenders. Those are going to be the people that we use our resources to detain.
Mm-hmm.
What remains then is less violent offenders. What do we do with them? And I think there's a movement toward coming with alternatives in the community when they remain in their homes, especially with youth,
mm-hmm.
and especially since we found, our research has found that lower level offenders actually do worse if you detain them and put them in the mm-hmm. same places. as more serious offenders.
Well, I think they probably learn a lot from the more serious offenders on how to offend differently or do things differently. Plus, they're more angry for being incarcerated and taken away from whatever support system that they did have.
Yeah, I think the research supports that. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I know that, and we had an author who had written a book on gangs, and that's one of the things that he had talked about, is that part of the recruiting of the gangs was to take some of those softer offenders and to provide them with protection on the basis that they became part of the gang. So it actually became a recruiting ground for them.
Sure.
Yeah. So you mentioned research. So how does that illustrate new trends or factors contributing towards the delinquency? And do you want to take that one?
Richard? Sure. Yeah. I think that some of the most recent research is pointing to some new environmental indicators that are kind of contributing to our juveniles today getting involved in delinquent behavior, joining gangs, and some of the research kind of substantiates what we've already known in law enforcement and in the treatment side of the field. One being the code of the street theory. That was some recent research done by a professor at Yale University that basically substantiates the fact that there is a code of the street that the kids follow, that they use for protection, mm-hmm. that regulates the use of violence and actually supplies a rationale for when to use violence and aggression in the street. I think what was surprising about that piece of research is the fact that I think we tend to believe that it's kids in inner city, lower socioeconomic background, minority type youth that join gangs and get involved in delinquent behavior. This research indicates that middle class youth are actually adopting the code of the street as for protection, and their parents are actually kind of turning a blind eye and kind of reinforcing, you know, you got to do what you got to do if you're gonna stay safe.
Hmm. I think that's accurate. I think you find that where I work in the city of Santa Monica, it's middle class to even upper middle class kids. You're finding that these kids are wanting to be seen as tougher. And so sometimes when you're having the discussion about why are you engaged in this particular activity, their responses are, well, I can't have people thinking that I'm soft or things like that. So you find... often, once you actually look at the data or you actually see it up close, you actually find behaviors that are different than you might have anticipated.
Right.
What kind of behaviors I'm curious about?
Well, I think, as Richard mentioned, the gang-oriented sort of this idea that there's a code of the street. So this idea, especially modernly, where kids are have the internet and they can look at YouTube and see how other kids are conducting themselves in other areas. Mm-hmm. So this idea, I had a kid say to me once that I'm saying, well, you know, why would you stop your car and get out of the car and go fight with those kids? Did you know them? And he said, no. I said, well, why? He said, well, they were looking at me. Hmm. And I didn't like the way they were looking at me. And I said, well, they don't know you, so how are you finding that offensive? And he said, well, I can't have these, you know, just because I live in this area where it's relatively affluent and it's a higher, so I don't want them to think I'm soft. So he got out of the car and engaged them in a physical altercation to demonstrate to them that, you know, he's not soft. Mm-hmm. And that was important enough to him at the time to get himself in, you know, involved in a situation where he could have been hurt and eventually was arrested.
Sure. Now, and I think we understand the whole point in regards to where a community-based program is going to be better than incarceration. Is it strictly a financial issue as to why it's now being looked at more so in relation to residential treatment?
I think I've been in this field a long time, and when I started, I came in as a social worker, and then came over from social work to working in probation. I feel like we're in the space between law enforcement and social work. But I never felt like there was an incongruence between the two. I always felt like it's important to have limit setting and boundaries and structure in order for kids to be healthy. You find that in homes, you find that in schools. So it's not incongruent with law enforcement and what they're trying to do. But for a long time, because they were two separate disciplines, folks sort of treated them as though they were. I think what you're seeing now is that it's forced people to say that the lack of resources has forced people to say, well, with what we have, what can we do, and what ought we to be doing? Mm-hmm. And it's I'm personally pretty happy to see things kind of come toward my way of thinking, if you will.
And you ask about what's kind of leading us into kind of down this path. I think we've known for a long time that detention facilities are not the proper place for these kids to get treatment. And actually, a couple of years ago, the Chief Probation Officers Association and the California Mental Health Directors Association put together a study where they surveyed 18 county probation departments here in California and found that 50 to 75% of the juveniles in there had a diagnosable mental health problem. Mm-hmm. And that the cost associated with those kids was right around $7,000 per incarceration more than the average juvenile in the system. So it's cost prohibitive, it's too expensive. We don't have the right treatment programs in the detention facilities, mm-hmm. because of lack of resources. And it's just timely now that things are actually starting to shift with the larger economic problems with our state and nationally, that the systems are taking a look at that.
Yeah, now give us a description of some of the community-based programs that are going on out there right now.
Well, with the probation department, there are a lot of collaborative efforts. Probably the biggest change in our department, and I'm not a policymaker, but there's a lot of smart people working really hard and trying to figure out what's important for our department to do, because we have some mandated services that are dictated by the Welfare and Institutions Code that must be provided to the courts and so forth. But we do have, I think the biggest change is we've started to move into working more closely with schools. We have a lot of deputies that are actually based on the school campuses. And so that's different than what used to happen, where you would get specifically be assigned to an area, but not specifically interact with the school. So, of course, schools, you see the kids every day, so there's more of a consistent presence. And as we see that we have distinctive roles, there's an opportunity to provide support for each other in our respective roles. For those of us who don't work in a school, we still work very closely with schools. One of the youth services network that I work with in Santa Monica, schools and their personnel are regular members of that process, and I'm often asked to come to a school, you know, sit in on a classroom, sit in on individual education plan meetings, mm-hmm. and I work very closely with the principals in that area.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And it sounds like they've gone a little bit back towards, I mean, I went to high school in the 70s in Pasadena, and the schools had student resource officers. So there was somebody, they had an office on campus, and people could go to them and talk about pretty much anything they wanted. And at the same time, you knew that if something happened, that was probably going to be the first person that was going to talk to you.
Mm-hmm. I think it's similar to that model, and it's not surprising that we find things that worked and we thought they were a good idea in the past. What we do have now is that the evidence, the research yields evidence, and there's this new movement toward what they call evidence-based practices, mm-hmm. so that the approaches that we choose are directly related to research that show these are the programs that work. So we want to replicate those, and things that don't work as well, mm-hmm. we want to try to move away from them.
Yeah, and Richard, you had something to add?
Yeah, and we're also seeing some very creative and innovative, even non-evidence-based practices that many systems are using across the country, mm-hmm. Utilizing the resources that they have. A lot of community-based programs like enhanced social skills classes and life skills classes in the community for kids, mm-hmm. Expanded aftercare programs, juvenile diversion programs for first-time or nonviolent offenders out there. Daytime curfew programs for kids who ditch school and get picked up, and allows police a place to take the youth so they don't get thrown in juvenile hall or get back into the court system. Mm-hmm. And even suspension centers, again, places for kids who are expelled or on suspension where they can go and continue to study and work to school before they, you know.
Right. So they aren't at home getting into trouble, correct. Wandering the streets and being bored all day and doing that. I want to go back for a moment to the juvenile hall. You were mentioning, you know, kids don't really belong there for treatment. I know you have the SHU where more the suicidal kids or the bipolar kids or kids that need to be on medication need to go. And whenever I was going to juvenile hall, there weren't very many kids there. So I would think for as many children that are having mental health issues based, are they not being detected when they get to juvenile hall right away? Or how is that done?
Well, just to clarify a couple of things.
Okay.
First of all, our juvenile halls are detention centers where kids go pending a disposition from their court hearings.
Okay.
So it's not actually a place to send a kid to receive treatment in the first place. It's sort of a temporary holding situation. However, as we know, sometimes the wheels of justice move slowly.
Mm-hmm.
So what we were finding is that sometimes kids, the court hearing would hold on, and we had this kid in detention. So kids were ending up in detention longer than anyone intended, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so then if a kid's going to be in detention 3, 6, 9 months, then you've got school issues, you have mental health. Obviously, if they have mental health needs, mm-hmm. there's going to be a need to address those. So what actually has happened is that there's a much increased use of electronic monitoring, which is sort of what they call the community detention program. And so while you're waiting for your court hearing to reach a disposition, you actually wear an ankle bracelet, and you're electronically monitored. You can continue going to school, and you're allowed to be receive treatment and mental health services in your home, along with, of course, the supervision of your parents.
Yeah, I when you said the bracelet, I had met so many people that cut the bracelet off.
Yeah.
They go home and it's like, well.
Sure. Well, you know, that it does. It's not that that doesn't happen.
Right.
But I think as they've expanded the use of it, obviously, you have a lot of kids who are complying with mm-hmm. it. And they have part of the community detention program is that they have officers who are monitoring whether or not the devices are working properly. And if you cut them off, it signals and they know exactly whose bracelet that is that's off.
Right.
And then you might find yourself detained mm-hmm. In juvenile hall.
Now, I'm just curious, too. You're talking about the mental health services for the children when they go back into the home. How often is it that the parents have to be involved in that, or do you have to wait till you go to court and say, you know, order family services as well as individual?
I think ideally, you know, you want parents involved as much as possible. The most successful programs seem to have parental involvement, whether it's mm-hmm. substance abuse treatment or their issues with family conflict. Even the substance abuse issues require parents to sort of take a look at how they themselves are coping, you mm-hmm. know, what their coping strategies are, what they're teaching in terms of their own. So when you have a kid and when you have a child that's doing sort of self-soothing by using drugs of some sort, there's a question about if we take that away, what's going to replace that?
Good point.
Is it going to be different kinds of support in the family system? Are there going to be alternatives? And, you know, can we give them a whole new peer network? And how would that be achieved? So it's really important for the parents to sort of have a strategy for, if I have this kid who's been engaged with these peers and these activities, what's going to be my strategy for helping them engage in a different way? Mm-hmm. So I think, and that's, it's all learning. It's, these kids don't come with any directions.
Absolutely. Richard had.
And aside from the clinical advantages for having family and parental involvement in treatment and aftercare, we're seeing a huge national movement by payers, health plans, and public sector payers, county and state systems, making it mandatory now that family be a part of treatment, that there be an aftercare component. We're even seeing treatment for parents prior to kids coming out of detention, coming out of a residential treatment program, and I think that's a good thing.
I think
the research shows that it improves outcomes and improves transition back and reentry back to community.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and I think to follow up with what Tommy just said, being the person who is often transporting the child to the residential treatment center, the component about the parents is huge. And what we're seeing, unfortunately, more and more is these parents that have a sense of entitlement to the point that they've had an IEP, their child is now going to a residential treatment center in another state, and the parents aren't even taking enough responsibility to let us know if the child took off in the middle of the night. We will literally set something up. We're going to be there at 4 o'clock in the morning. We're going to pick up your child. The state is paying for all of this, and we get there at 4 o'clock in the morning, and the parents go, oh, you know, I wondered when I heard something at about midnight that maybe they weren't here, but yet from the standpoint of an entitlement, they just look at us and go, well, when they come back, I guess you'll have to come back and get them. There is no responsibility of, gee, maybe I should have called somebody. Maybe I should have tried to keep them here. They really feel like they're relinquishing all of their responsibility for that child.
Well, and also the child to be able to go out in the middle of the night. They have a history of that. You would think that if they heard a sound, maybe they'd get up and look.
Exactly.
Well, that sort of gives you a glimpse into the level of dysfunction in the family.
Right.
Where children are out at 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, where at a glance you could say, hey, that's no good.
Right. They're right? 14.
Yeah, it's not hard to figure out that's not okay. So when you have a parent, and that seems to be the pattern that you can observe in the family, you know that things have gone seriously awry. And so those are circumstances where a residential setting, I think, is appropriate if it's the appropriately targeted residential setting that will meet the kid's mental health needs. And often they do a really good job of sort of helping the family restructure their relationship, mm-hmm. so that parents become parents again, and the kids sort of realize, I had a kid call me one day and say, we were working with him through our, I had the wraparound program, was working with mm-hmm. him, and they were working the in-home parenting services, which is one of the ones that is available now to parents. The in-home parent service is working with the mom on restructuring her parents. And he called me and said, my mom grounded me. What am I supposed to do? Like, I said, well,
it's a first.
I said, is that your first time being grounded? He said, yeah. He said, I didn't know I was going to be grounded for this. I said, well, that's something you're going to have to talk over with your mom. You might want to find out what you need to do to get off of that particular consequence and how to avoid it in the future. So there is there's sort of this assumption that we have that parents know exactly what to do. But in my work, I find often that that's just simply not the case. And the strength-based assessments that have sort of been new part of the movement allows us to take a look at families like this where maybe the parent doesn't have good parenting skills, but it's clear that they have maintained an investment in this child over the years. And so when you can say to them, Richard mentioned an important word earlier, and it's one of my favorite ones, this one, when you're talking about outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When you can say, I believe that your kid, that this can be there can be a positive outcome, that your child can have a life that you've imagined for them, but you need to make these changes. But I believe that those mm-hmm. changes will have this result, and it'll be a good outcome for your child. A lot of times, parents who have had children in trouble in schools and things like that, they haven't heard anything positive about outcomes for their children in a very long time.
If at all.
Yeah. So it's something that they can grab onto, and it's that sort of the first step in trying to initiate change in the family system.
That's great.
And give them hope.
Absolutely.
So that's a critical part. Maybe they can step up and be parents again, because there is something that they could possibly do to help their child.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, you're talking in the middle of the night, children being out at 3 or 4 in the morning. I just keep remembering this a commercial or a PSA that used to come in the middle of the night, that nothing good happens after midnight. That's what I try to tell the kids. Nothing good happens after 10 o'clock at night. So you have a 10 o'clock curfew, that's a good thing. Yeah.
Well, that's a good point.
In fact, you were talking about kids that often have like daytime curfews. You know, are there curfews in place for children in LA County or San Bernardino County where they're not allowed to be out after midnight? Or what happens if they're found after midnight?
Well, all municipalities, whether they're cities or county areas, have a curfew. And it's usually about 10 o'clock.
Okay.
Where I work in the city of Monterey Park over in East Los Angeles, curfew there is 10 o'clock, and our police officers and gang officers will cite juveniles who are out beyond 10 o'clock, and it's a small fine, and it orders an appearance by the child and their parents mm-hmm. to come to court and have to face a judge and kind of explain what's going on, and a lot of times that's kind of the first step of letting the justice system kind of start sorting out what's going on with the child and maybe offering some support or services to the parents.
Yeah, I would imagine a lot of parents don't even realize that's on the books, so to speak, that there is an actual curfew, that their children are not supposed to be out alone with anybody under 18.
Well, those are enforced differently in different jurisdictions. So that's a good point, part of the sort of confusion for parents and kids. For example, kids will always ask me, like, well, what if I'm at a movie? So movies start, if I go to a movie, it starts at 8:30. Mm-hmm. It's a 3-hour movie. Now he's out, movie's out 11:30. Have I violated curfew? And I think most often in most jurisdictions, they're sort of blending the two activities. They're saying, okay, look, here near the mall where we know people go to the movies, we're going to give you a certain amount of time to clear this space, get home, and demonstrate that you're conducting yourself in an appropriate fashion. Mm-hmm. However, if we still see you lingering here after the mall's closed, the movies are over, it's 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, you're in the parking lot with a bunch of kids, something's going to go wrong here if we allow that to continue. So they'll either disperse it or they'll use curfew as a way of sort of enforcing a general idea that we're all better off if these kids go home after their recreational mm-hmm. activities are over.
Right, and I think that's a great point. And I just ran into that as a parent myself. And my 17-year-old went to a movie. It got out again about whatever 10:15, 10:30, and I was picking him up. And as I was on my way there, he called me and he said, "Dad, how far away are you?" And I said, "I'm about 5 minutes away." He says, "Okay." He said, "The local officer here came by and asked us, what time did the movie that you were in get out? And how soon will your parents be here to pick you up?" So they didn't. It wasn't a harassment thing, but they were just asking the question, pointing out that if you have a parent on the way, enjoy, take time. But if you can't answer that question, I think they were going to take it a little further.
And framing that, a lot of times in discussing these issues with parents, framing that conversation around not so much punishing your children, but mm-hmm. this is how we keep children safe.
Exactly, right. And that's exactly how it was posed, and I thought that was great. He just asked him when, didn't tell him, look, you better be out of here by such and such a time, mm-hmm. just asked him the question, was happy with the answer, and moved on to talk with somebody else.
And that's one of the ways that law enforcement is sort of engaging with communities now, is sort of supporting the parental, what has traditionally been a parental role, but supporting the parent. And so when you see the child, or you encounter the child in the community, they're interacting with them in a way that supports the parent's contention that you need to be home at a little while. I remember the commercial that used to say, "It's 10 o'clock. Do you know where your children are?"
Yeah, that one too.
Yep.
And I think that's a very reasonable question. I wish I could, I had some way of sending that to homes of all of my probation parents, parents of my probation clients. "It's 10 o'clock. Do you know where your children are?"
Yeah, are they really in bed, or did you hear that screen open and shut behind you? But I was thinking a couple different things, actually. But as far as the community, well, it used to be, you mentioned the probation, or the law enforcement are in a gentle way supporting the family. It used to be, as a community, it took a village to raise a child, and we were all looked out for each other's kids, and everybody's so disconnected now, it seems like. So how can we get back, in your opinion, as a community? The police officers are beginning that trend to start gently taking care of our children.
Well, I think, and Tommy mentioned a little bit earlier, that law enforcement agencies are taking a different position in terms of being a little more flexible on the enforcement and more working with the kids, working with families, identifying in the community who the frequent flyers are of the kids that we know are always getting in trouble. Maybe they're not in a gang yet. We'll go out now and make contact with the family, put them in contact with law enforcement counselors, gang diversion type counselors, to start talking, have that dialogue about if your child continues to be out late, if they continue to be hanging around a certain type of crowd, these are the things that could come out of that. And so not there to beat down the door and take people to jail, but more to really kind of form a partnership. And we've taken it beyond that to even working with businesses where kids may hang out, and having them give us information and partner with us so that they can call us when they see certain things happening or crowds gathering, so we don't have to wait for the fight to break out. Mm-hmm. And now everybody comes rolling lights and siren and kids are going to jail. So it really is a more proactive way of community-based policing is mm-hmm. what we call it.
Well, how can the general community at large be supportive of that, do you think?
Well, I think the community at large, that's a very interesting question and an important one, I think, because often, you know, I've seen situations where the police had a strategy or an approach for just trying to diminish the criminality in a particular location. And when they start doing it, you know, they stop and question children. The parents sort of get up in arms, and they're unhappy about their children. They feel like, well, you know, you're harassing our children. And so then the police are sort of, you know, that wasn't their intention. They were trying to keep the, they thought, well, we're going to make this area safer because there are a lot of children here. So I think what's happening is I think the open arms have to go both ways. Mm-hmm. I think that as police agencies are recognizing the value of community-based strategy and community policing, I think everyone's a little happier with the outcomes that are part of that. But I think also I would encourage citizens to, it is your police department, to say to your police chief, I would give a little plug to our Santa Monica police, my law enforcement partners in Santa Monica, Chief Jackman and their approach in community policing has been very effective at working collaboratively with service providers and schools and also our agency, and sharing information and approaches and sometimes joint operations at how can we, you know, sort of focus on keeping these kids safer. And that, and the messaging is really important there, I think, you know, for community members who want to be supportive of that effort and want, I think they can reach out and talk to their local police chief and say, how can we be partners? Mm-hmm. I think it's a reasonable question and it works well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I like it. And it sounds like what we're getting is that we're getting preventative measures through education. And it, I mean, that just sounds like the right direction. It sounds like we're really doing the right thing. We're going to take a break. We're going to be right back. We are talking with Richard Lewis III and Tommy Baines, and we are talking about community-based services and how it benefits all of us. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. All right, we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family, and we are talking about community-based programs. And with us is Richard Lewis III and Tommy Baines. And Richard, I'm somebody who has some knowledge about Open Minds, but if you can share with our listeners a little more information about Open Minds' role in the private and public sectors of health and human services.
Well, Open Minds is a national behavioral health care consulting firm, and we work primarily with payers, both in the public and private sector, as well as providers, for-profit and nonprofit. And I think our strengths are a strong market research component that we bring to providers and payers with regard to strategic planning and positioning in the community, how to work with large systems, both on the business side as well as on the administration and management side, if you're a county system, if you're a Medicaid system. Mm-hmm. One example of some of the work that we did that we're talking a little bit about today was some research that we did with 20 county juvenile justice systems for some of our providers in the Midwest. And looking at what the trends are in terms of with the fiscal problems that most states are having right now and that trickle-down effect to counties, how's that affecting juvenile justice systems, not only on the detention enforcement side, but also on the treatment and community reentry side. And I think we hit on some of the points already, as Tommy's pointed out, here in Los Angeles County, and that is that it's been very expensive. They don't have to provide mental health services for these kids. They don't have the funding they used to, and they're moving towards moving kids out in the community, doing more of the community-based services. But the other thing that's come out of that, I think that's important, is that it's kind of changing the way that residential treatment programs now are operating, how they're interfacing with payers and referral sources like the county systems, and that is that they're embracing that family-centered approach. They're incorporating into their programs more reintegration, reentry type aftercare programs. They're making changes like adding females where they only treated males. We're seeing a real increase in female delinquency across the country, and if most providers aren't prepared to deal with the female population, they're very different, even in the detention setting, to be able to manage. So we're seeing a lot of positive changes coming out of the budget deficit issue and response by treatment providers to better meet the needs for referral sources and payers like county probation departments, as an example.
When you talk about treatment providers, what providers exactly are you talking about?
Everything from outpatient clinic providers to special education providers with school districts, residential treatment providers, both in-state, you know, locked and unlocked, just the whole gamut.
Okay.
And I think that's another thing that's worth mentioning is what it's forcing to do is when you have a lack of resources, we're finding more and more people are coming together. So there's more of an integrated approach, even with residential treatment providers, to be able to pull into the treatment planning process the special ed teacher that the client is going to be going back to school, the psychiatrist back at home if they're placed somewhere far away, churches and clergy, and just all those kinds of people are now being brought into the fray, and that wasn't something that used to happen in the past.
Right.
I think it's also forced a reliance on coordination, and in social work service delivery, there's a term called fragmentation of services, and I'm always very conscious of, you know, a kid goes to court and he gets probation conditions, and they order counseling and anger management, community service, and a number of things that could be part, maybe also substance abuse counseling. And if those services are not provided in a coordinated fashion and it's not integrated, it makes it very difficult. And there's some things that a lot of times you don't think about, but, you know, it comes up when I, you know, talk to a kid about, okay, you know, where are we going to do these things? Simple things like that we sort of take for granted, like transportation. You know, right. And you think, well, you know, this place is only 6 miles from your home. But it might be 6 miles from their home, and then crossing over into a whole new gang neighborhood.
Right.
The facility may close prior to the time if the kid gets out of school at a certain time. By the time they're able to catch the bus over there, it's not available to them. So things like the hours that the place is open. I'll give another plug to one of our service providers in Santa Monica who's been just wonderful at extending themselves into our, they work with kids in the schools, in some of the youth centers, at the Boys and Girls Club, and also in some of the homes. So, and that's St. John's Child and Family Center. It's been wonderful in the way that they've extended themselves to us and with our probation youth and some of the other youth in our schools. And what I'm always happy about, Richard and I originally sort of got formed our sort of alliance in our effort to get services to kids. I didn't want kids to have to get arrested in order for them to get the services they require. And I think it's important to have the network set up so that if the child is identified by the family, parents are the first one to see the problems, and then, or the schools, or even a church or a friend. A child should not have to be part of the criminal justice system in order to get the service that they need. And I think that's sort of been one of the things that's been acknowledged with the resources, that there are a lot of times where a child has contact with other folks in the that are part of the system who could refer them to get the appropriate services and maybe, as you mentioned, Alan, prevent, you know, the result that the child is in the criminal justice system. So I think that's sort of the difference that has changed, is that we're not seeing that child who comes to us in the criminal justice system as distinct from the children who are receiving the same kinds of services for the same kinds of problems in other places.
Yeah, we're talking about kids that have family in the area, et cetera, but you're over in Santa Monica. I know there's a lot of squatters. There's a lot of runaway kids that hang out in the Santa Monica area. How do you service them?
Well, it's a combination of things. It's, Santa Monica has a wonderful, the city of Santa Monica has been really good in taking leadership in homeless services, and their human services department is very active. In fact, the youth services network there was initiated by the city of Santa Monica and the Parks and Recs folks, who wanted to put together a program called that they called Night Bridges for kids after school. Because there's a lot of parents that are working until 5, maybe by the time their transportation is done, you might not be home till 6 or 7. Kids get out of school. Some of these kids are out of school at 1:30. So that's 4.5 hours of unsupervised time, and unsupervised and unstructured. I always say that, you know, you put 4 or 5 kids together and 5 or 6 hours of unstructured time, it's only a matter of time for somebody comes up with something that's a little naughty.
Yep.
That's a good way to put it.
Oh, you got that right. And we do have some questions that have been sent in by the listeners. Again, I always want to thank the listeners. We really appreciate the fact that you're taking the time to put the questions in. And one of the ones I want to ask, and this one was directed directly to Dr. Melody. And it says, given that you work with families with teens, I presume you have dealt with community-based programs. Can you tell us about your experience and if you feel they are going to work as well as the state anticipates they will?
Well, I can't speak for the state, so I don't know what their anticipation is. Yes, I have worked with community-based programs for over 16 years, and my experience is there's good ones and there's bad ones. I mean, it really depends. I think funding is a huge portion of it. Unfortunately, they're looking... You know, the nonprofits are looking for more public funding or private funding for their services because the public funding is dwindling, as you well know. So they have to diversify a little bit. I think when they work really well. But I think it's a community effort. I mean, those community-based programs, it's going out providing services where the children are, at the schools or at the church or at Boys and Girls Club. You go where they are. Because it's often very difficult for families to get them to the services themselves. Also, to incorporate the families in the process as well, because it could be that they just don't have the parenting skills, and they need to learn that on how to set limits, set boundaries, expectations for their children so they have something to live up for. And then you have some parents that are in a total disconnect and have no interest in them, so how do you provide the services and support for those children to help find their talents and abilities and support them in getting in a direction or a goal so they don't get sidetracked in all the things that get them into trouble. This is a whole topic I keep going on, and we're running out of time. I want to make sure we get back. But I think we have to support the community-based systems and programs a lot more, and I think we do that too as a community, as being part of the solution and the support, and also stepping up and being okay with going, hey, you know, it's not okay to be graffitiing my mailbox. Not okay, not cool, guys, you know, in a nice, gentle way.
Yeah. Oh, and I think you bring up a great point about the fact that in some cases you're going to have better services than others. So my question, and I probably to Tommy or Richard, is there a prototype? Is there somebody who has really stepped up to a point that they're now being used as the prototype for other cities if they feel like it's not working for them, or if there's a county out there that says, you know, we just really feel like this isn't working, you know, is there somewhere they can go to and say, okay, here's the prototype, here's the system that works, so that now we're taking a really great community program and sharing it with everybody so that other counties, states, and such can benefit from it?
Well, the Office of Criminal Justice Planning out of Washington does a really good job of going out and finding programs who can be models for, you know, program development in different in different jurisdictions. You do have to be careful because a lot of times there's like, for instance, there's a great program out of Miami-Dade right now that's had a lot of success, and they're thinking about, you know, people are looking at it for implementation here, but obviously we're different. Mm-hmm. You know, Los Angeles County would be the sixth biggest state if it were a state.
Right.
So the size, and there are a lot of different things that you have to consider in terms of implementation. But I think there are things that you can learn from looking at a successful mm-hmm. program. What seems to be commonly the most successful thing for me is that I like when I hear, and we have had wonderful community partners throughout Los Angeles County, and those folks work, the nonprofits work. You know, a lot of times they're providing valuable services in places where they're not available otherwise, and it really is, you know, it's a labor of love for most of these communities. So they've been important partners, and I think that what you see recently is them asking, what else do we need? That's what I like to see, is agencies that are coming to the table and saying, you know, what does this population need? What's needed here? And then providing some of those services where you sort of fill in the gaps, because a lot of these children have fallen out of the systems that typically would have supported them.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Because I think there is a difference between a rural area, what works in rural country area, absolutely, and urban versus suburban. Yes.
You. No.
It's me. Okay. I'm being pointed at for something. I don't know what.
Well, better you than me.
No, that's okay. And just to get through the guest questions, we've got about the listener questions. We've got about 4 minutes now.
That's
awful. So anyway, we have one that came in. This person emailed in saying that as a therapist in Los Angeles County, approximately 20% of my clients are juveniles who have already spent time outside the state in treatment programs. My experience has been that the majority return to their family, that the family still has minimal participation in their therapy. Within weeks or months, these kids have regressed to ground zero or below. I am hoping that community-based programs will require more participation of the family, especially the parents, and in my practice, I believe it would yield very high results. I would like your comments on this.
I'll make the first comment on the residential treatment component. It sounds like in the case of these kids, they were sent out of state to a residential program. Mm-hmm. Not all residential programs are alike. Some are better than others. They all have different structures. They all have different expectations. I think anybody who's shopping for a residential treatment program needs to kind of look into the details of the program and look for exactly that. We're looking for an aftercare program. We're looking for reintegration mm-hmm. back to the community. We're looking for even mandated, you know, family participation during the treatment process,
and
some way for it to be mandated when they come back to. And one way to do that is to work with probation, working with the courts. Many of these kids are a part of that system, and maybe you know, bringing some teeth from that avenue. Especially if you have the probation officer on the treatment team, that would be their role to kind of make sure when they're coming back, they're bringing resources and you know, that type of thing.
I was just wondering, for the kids that are not hooked up into the probation system and, you know, parents are trying to get them before they get into that, and you're talking about getting more teeth, do you find that probation departments or some of the Los Angeles County or other area police departments are pretty good at stepping up and maybe doing those scare techniques or coming in and talking to the kids going, look, you don't want to go down this area, down this path?
It's not unusual for a therapist to ask me to speak to children mm-hmm. and encourage them to shift their activities in some way. I would say that I don't find that kids are really afraid of law enforcement, or certainly they're not afraid of me. They might be startled by our original conversation, but I find that kids are receptive to adults saying to them, I see a different future for you mm-hmm. If you can make better choices.
Right.
And because I see you doing, a lot of times kids are doing a lot of things right. They may hear a lot about what they're doing wrong, but a lot of times I see kids who are making it to school regularly. They're, you know, they may decide to stay out too long on the weekend or maybe not come home at all on the weekend, but you know, there are 7 days in the week and they're there the other 6 days. So
right.
It's I also think for particularly for therapists, one of the things that comes up, and for therapists, in my work, when I was with a social worker with Child and Family Services, and you know the stint I had as a in clinical training, sometimes the work has to be about teaching the children to live with the parent they have.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And make the best of that circumstance. We all have to play the cards we get dealt in life, and your parent may not end up dramatically different because you went to treatment. But your changes and the changes that a child can make in themselves, especially because they're getting older and they're making their own choices, that's why I love working with adolescents. They can have an impact on the entire family, and especially on their own lives, regardless if their parents change or not.
Well, Tommy, say that more beautifully.
Absolutely, and it's a great way for us to wrap this up. And Tommy and Richard, you guys are making a difference in a beautiful way in the lives of many families. Thank you for that. We appreciate it. I believe our listeners do. Unfortunately, we're out of time. And actually, it was even a couple more questions. And I think what I'll do is I'll either ask you off the air or I'll email them to you. If you guys can email us some answers, we'll put that on our website or something. Now, real quickly, Richard, if anybody has questions for Open Minds, how can they reach Open Minds?
They can either go to our website at openminds.com. Or I'm happy to people can contact me directly at rlewis@openminds.com.
Great. And Tommy, if anybody has a question specifically for you, are you comfortable with giving them a way to reach you?
Certainly. They can contact the show,
Absolutely.
And I'll leave my contact information
Absolutely.
Here for you.
That would be great. That's www.answers4thefamilyblog.com. Thank you, gentlemen and listeners. We hope that you will be with us again next week.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Have a good one.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.